Good afternoon, everybody. Hello and welcome to CollectorFest. I am Guy Hansen. I'm a senior curator in social history here at the National Museum of Australia. And today we're looking at royal memorabilia. So it's a right royal affair today. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a quick look at some of the collections from the National Museum of Australia. We've also got today one of Australia's leading experts, Professor Peter Sperrett from the University of Queensland, who's a collector himself, but also a broader expert in Australian history and the significance of the monarchy for Australia. And we're also going to go on and discuss some items which members of the audience have brought along, some pieces from their own collections. I should just mention just briefly that when this event was advertised, we were hoping to have Cecil Ballard, one of the biggest royal collectors in Australia, here today. But unfortunately, Cecil fell ill, and Peter very kindly has stepped into his shoes. So if you're expecting Cecil, I'm sorry. I'll show you a picture of him, though, in a couple of minutes. He'd be very disappointed not to be here. He lives for events such as these. A bit of housekeeping. Toilets are just around the corner here. As I think somebody's already asked, please turn your mobiles off at this point if you have not already done so. This event is being recorded, so if that worries you in some way, I give you forewarning. And there's some evaluation forms, I think, left on chairs. And if you have a chance, we'd appreciate you filling them in and returning them to us. I think there's a box over here, and that helps us make these events better in the future. Before we launch into the main part of the proceedings and actually start talking royal memorabilia, I'm just going to ask Leanne Dempsey to tell us a little bit more about CollectorFest.
Hi everybody, my name is Leanne. Some of you might have met me before because I'm the person behind the CollectorFest website, which is a website on our National Museum of Australia site. I'll get some information up about it in a moment. Now, CollectorFest is a series of events that we hold at the National Museum of Australia celebrating the art of collection. We are one of Australia's largest collecting organisations here at the National Museum of Australia, and many of the staff who work for the museum are also keen collectors. I enjoy collecting cocktail paraphernalia, for example. So we all understand the lure of a good collection here. We started up the CollectorFest events to give collectors in Canberra and surrounds an opportunity to meet each other, to socialise over a cup of tea and coffee, and to show each other the beautiful objects that we have in our collection and the things that we love. But as a little extra something in between events, we thought it would be great to have a website established. If you are a person who has an internet connection and enjoys a little bit of socialising online, this picture that you can see up here is the front page of our CollectorFest website. Anybody can register as a member of the website. It's completely free. And once you're on board, we can have conversations about our collections. We have access to museum staff members, such as conservators, who are available to provide information about, for example, taking care of your collections, storing your collections. And today I'll be stalking around downstairs during the tea and coffee with a camera person, and I may very well tap you on the shoulder and ask you a few questions if you give me your permission to do so. And we upload these little interviews and this kind of information on the website. So if anybody wanted to be here and they weren't able to make it, it's an opportunity to see a little bit of what we do here. I'll just show you one other page. This is a sample of the type of information that we'll be uploading onto the website. We had an open day at the National Museum of Australia last year, and you can see that there is a series of little videos with me in my red T-shirt chatting with people about the open day. And underneath, I'm sure everyone recognises that lovely, glamorous woman sitting there. That's Mrs. Margaret Fulton, who was here for a previous event. So if you're interested in joining us, we'd love to see you on the CollectorFest website, and you may very well see your own face on there at some stage in future if you give us your permission. So enjoy today very much.
Thank you very much, Leanne. It's a great website, and you know, I know a lot of people are fascinated by collecting, so a great opportunity to socialise and to develop your interest in that area. So let's come to the subject of today, which is royal memorabilia. The National Museum of Australia collects royal memorabilia and material associated with the monarchy in Australia. Why do we do that? Well, our interest is the history of Australia, and what's more important than, in some ways, the constitutional groundwork of Australia and the fact that Australia is a constitutional monarchy. So there's very good political history reasons why we should collect royal memorabilia, but there's also very good social and popular culture reasons why we should as well. And when I think of this, I can't go past the 1954 Royal Tour, which was a landmark event in Australia's history, where a huge number of Australians witnessed that event, and it left an indelible impression. And then as you go through the history of the Royals since then, many of them and many events associated with them have really left a powerful mark on Australia's historical imagination. So as the National Museum of Australia and our role in preserving the nation's memory and history, it's very appropriate that we do collect some royal memorabilia. So I'll show you a few bits and pieces in our collection. We can compare notes on our collections now. So I mentioned the 1954 Royal Tour, and this is one of my favourite photographs of that tour. It just seems to capture the moment of the young Queen in a Daimler driving past the adoring crowds. We do have earlier material as well. This is a Crosley, which was used in the 1927 Royal Tour. We have recently acquired one of the Daimlers. There was a fleet of Daimlers used in 54, and we've acquired this Daimler, and we're beginning a major restoration project of it. Of course, many of you will have memories of seeing the Queen in a Land Rover, and there was quite a few Land Rovers used during different royal tours, and we have one which was used in the 60s. And, of course, I think one of the things which many people have in their collections and many people will have seen is the cover of is women's magazines, and particularly the Australian Women's Weekly, and this is a particularly good example of the sorts of things that people collect and is in our collections. And I mentioned Cecil, who can't be here in person, and Cecil is every inch the royalist that he looks, is absolutely devoted to Queen Elizabeth. I think fell in love with Queen Elizabeth as a young man when he saw her in 1954, and has remained passionately in love ever since. And I'm not being entirely ironic. He really does adore Queen Elizabeth, and he would have loved to be here to tell you more about his collection today, but unfortunately can't. One of my favourite objects, which we've recently acquired, is the Dargie portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. You might think, how have we got it? Because it's hanging up in Parliament House. Well, there are actually two copies were made by Dargie at the time of painting. He made a second copy because he was concerned that the first copy might be destroyed as it was being air freighted back to Australia. And he was so concerned that he actually painted a second one. And he took the first one he did, turned it upside down and copied it in order to try and make sure it was true as copy as possible. So there is actually a third copy as well, because not long after the painting was unveiled, the Queen actually requested a copy as well. So Dargie did three of these wattle dress paintings. And this image of Queen Elizabeth II is perhaps one of the most influential images, and it was used on immigration certificates, and it was often the prints of this particular painting often appeared in council chambers and government offices. So it's a very famous image, and it's great that we've got one of the original paintings in our collection. Another shot of our Daimler, which looks quite beautiful like that, but when we're finished doing some work on it, we'll look even better. So now, I will introduce our expert for today, Peter. Peter is a highly respected historian in Australia. He's currently in the University of Queensland, but he has previously worked at Macquarie and ANU and Monash. And he's also, as well as being an academic historian, he's been a long-term collector. And he has a range of collecting interests. Quite famously, he collected a lot of memorabilia associated with the Harbour Bridge. And that research resulted in a book and an exhibition which he worked on. And he's also collected a lot of stuff, a lot of memorabilia associated with Queen Elizabeth II, again, resulting in publications and exhibitions. And As a historian, I think he's a very important historian. He's a historian I look up to because he combines that interest in material culture, objects, with broader history and brings them together. And there's not many historians who do that. And that's exactly what we try to do here at the National Museum of Australia. So it's a great privilege to have him here today. So I've got a selection of objects from Peter's collection. There's quite a large collection, a couple of hundred objects of his, which are in the National Museum of Australia. And I've just got a few examples which we can quickly talk about. So what do you want to tell me about this particular little handkerchief here, Peter?
Well, I guess my collection really started through my maternal grandmother who went to the coronation. So she was always very proud of having been to the coronation and gone to the garden party and so on. And in her rosewood lead light cabinet, she had a boxed set of the coronation coach with the metal horses. And she still kept the box.
Here it is here, Peter.
Which people often did. So as a kid growing up, first my maternal grandmother lived in Gympie and then in Budrum. I always used to think as a young child how fascinating this sort of souvenir was, I guess, of her going to the coronation. And at this point, I need to ask you, is there anybody here who was alive in 1954 who didn't see the Queen and the Duke in person?
Well, I didn't live in this country, though.
That's all right. Now, what about those of us who were alive in 1954 who did see them in person? Good, we're using this for statistical purposes. So a quick segue is that in the early 1980s, I was starting to do some research on the 1954 Royal Tour, which, as you'll recall, was the first tour by a reigning monarch other than the earlier object, of course, where people came out for the opening of Parliament House. And Gallup poll evidence at the time shows that 2/3 of Australians saw the Queen and the Duke in the flesh on the 1954 tour. So how many of you here saw them on the back of a railway carriage, for instance, for 54? How many in a schoolyard? So I want you to think about where you saw them. Anyway, a higher proportion of Australians saw the Queen and the Duke in 1954 in the flesh than British people have ever seen them in the flesh, because it was so unusual to have a reigning monarch visit, and my colleague Ken Inglis sums this up very nicely in the phrase that finally Australians could see the face on the money in their own streets. So in a sense, this kind of became the start of a collection, but only about 20 or 30 years after I first saw it.
Sure. Well, let's just take a step back from 54 and to this George VI souvenir.
Yep. So here we have a souvenir produced. So this is their coronation. That's right. This is their coronation souvenir. And, of course, they had, under different nomenclature, been here for the opening of Parliament House in 1927 because of the Duke and Duchess of York, is that right?
Yes.
That's, yep.
In the actual Crosley, which I was showing before.
Okay. Yes, yep. Yep. And I guess, though those of you who have seen the King's speech or know your royal history will know that this coronation occurred in somewhat vexed circumstances. And I suppose the popular press in Australia always covered royal matters, but there's no comparison between the amount of coverage generated by that coronation and the coronation in 53. And I think it's partly because the monarchy, not only in Britain but in what were then called the Dominions, had become a lot more relevant again through the course of World War II, so that there was a wider interest in the monarchy in a wider variety of magazines and press coverage.
So what's great about an object like this is it's not just a piece of ephemera. It actually is a window into big historical events.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's go forward. We'll go past your coronation And we'll head into 54, which we talked about. So this is a good example of the sorts of memorabilia from 54, isn't it?
Yes, you've got an absolute outpouring of material before and after. And probably some of you know there was a royal tour proposed in 1952, which didn't happen because of the death of the king, which was going to be Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip. And the amount of memorabilia really produced in 54 is unending. I suppose the interesting question with a lot of this material is when are the print runs so great that the material remains really quite common and when is it rare? But as Guy would know, in curatorial circles, sometimes something that was very common once now becomes rare simply because stuff gets tossed out from deceased estates and so on. So the question of whether particular items survive or not. So these sorts of pictorial booklets can still be picked up quite cheaply. Yes. Because they did have big print runs.
Here's another example of the sorts of books you could buy.
And that one, that's a little brochure which would have been given to, I think, most school kids. From memory, it's about 20 pages long. And most school kids who took part in any aspect of the 54 Royal Tour also got a little medallion. So one of the most difficult situations I've ever faced on talkback radio was when a guy rang up saying he had one of these little medallions given to him as a school kid and he was assuming it was worth thousands of dollars. And I had to tell him that there are at least a couple of hundred thousand of them, and they actually, I urged him to keep his, but they weren't rare. So he was a bit shocked at that.
Of course, the magazines went to town on Queen Elizabeth, didn't they?
Absolutely. This one, those of you with long memories will recall, this is Pix magazine, first published in Australia in 1938, and it was the first time we had a photojournalist magazine in Australia, like Life, say, in the US. All Pix consisted of was lots of pictures and captions, and not much prose, and it was very popular in hairdressers, salons and so on. For the best way I can describe it, it's the modern equivalent of Who Weekly, another shocking magazines that people here under 30 might actually have read.
It was a glossy before they were glossy.
Yes, yep, yeah. Yep. And they had a field day. Tea Caddy. You'll appreciate, of course, from the museum's point of view, as well, there's an enormous difference in these sorts of objects between whether they're likely to survive in pretty good nick like this one. So ceramics are much more likely to survive. Any of these objects made of tin, and there were a lot, are very subject to humidity and so on. So they're often pretty...
Now, in terms of the objects that you collect, I think some of the most interesting and moving in some ways are the scrapbooks, of which there are many. This is one from your collection.
Yep. The scrapbooks, a lot of this collection came about because we did an exhibition at the Powerhouse Museum in 1993 called Australians and the Monarchy. I've got a few copies of the catalogue to show you. And we just started doing talkback radio, and people would offer scrapbooks and so on for the exhibition. From a historian's point of view, scrapbooks actually can be bloody irritating, because if you're keeping any now, make sure you put the date of the item down and the name of the publication, because it's a curse from a historian's point of view, because you've often got to imagine. But as a display object in a museum, and especially if you know what's called the provenance of the object, how old was the person when they put it together, scrapbooks are pretty evocative, because you get a sense of especially of girls following through the royal family over 20 or 30 years with a scrapbook.
And very famous image of the young of Elizabeth as a young girl.
Indeed, yep.
And, of course, we talked a little bit about ceramics, and another major set of items which is common in collections is ceramics with Charles and Di.
Indeed, and I guess what obviously happens before any royal event is there's a big build-up in a variety of items of memorabilia. So the ceramics are the classic, And the new item, which I hope isn't in the National Museum's collection, that I just picked up the other day, is I was in a Melbourne postcard shop, and I just happened to notice this LP record. It's got Australia on it, and I first of all was interested in it because I'm interested in how cities promote themselves. So it's got Perth, Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra, Christchurch and Wellington. But imagine how excited I was when I started looking further down to discover souvenir record to commemorate the Royal Tour 1952. So that was the tour that Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip were supposed to come on, and her father died, King died, and so they couldn't come. And as a comment on terminology you wouldn't use anymore, this has been produced by the Gay Gordons, no doubt an amusing group, and the City of Empire Police Pipe Band. It's conducted by Frederick Curzon. So it's typical, and then we've got... So actually, these are still worth looking out for. There were a lot of souvenirs produced for the 1952 Royal Tour, which didn't ever happen.
And 49 as well.
And 49 as well, when the King was supposed to be coming out, and I think he fell ill and couldn't. The question then, of course, I mean, back to the earlier point I was trying to make, this is a classic. These sorts of things don't tend to survive. You know, it's an LP record, it's fragile, all you've got to do is, knock it. It's very, very brittle. So, and whereas the ceramics, of course, going back to about 1911, the ceramics are the long-term survivors of this. And one of the interesting things I was mentioning to the guy when we were chatting about this before is the value of a lot of this sort of stuff waxes and wanes. So just probably within a couple of years of the marriage, the market in Charles and Di souvenirs was quite robust. That's how an antique dealer would describe it. And it's not so robust now. It sort of seems it's a past era. The other issue, of course, is what's the basic ceramic and design quality? And the interesting thing about a lot of royal memorabilia is that it seems to me to go the full gamut from pretty classy to, you'd have to describe that, I think, as a relatively cheesy image. So you're not always getting sort of high-profile ceramics. And, of course, another thing for those of you who are still collecting material have to pay a lot of attention to now is where are the ceramics made? Are they made in the UK or are they made in China?
Yes. Of course, another thing which a lot of interest in Lady Di focused on fashion. So there's a lot of magazines and books which concentrate on those items as well.
A lot of magazines and books, and one of the difficulties that museums have, and we had when we did this exhibition with the Powerhouse Museum, is that we wanted to have a cover of the new idea with Lady Di on it, and we simply couldn't afford what's called the permission charges. So here's a cover of the new idea with Lady Di on the front, okay? Well, we couldn't afford the permission charge the photographer wanted for his shot of Lady Di. So the solution was that that's Adrian Young's mum holding up the new idea because that got us round the copyright issue. See, we made Adrian's mum a cup of tea, but she didn't send us an invoice, for $3,000.
You heard it here first. Tips on avoiding copyright fees. Thanks. As a collector, you're not just interested in material which celebrates the monarchy, are you? You're also interested in some of the material which has been produced by the Republican movement.
Indeed. We ran a conference in London in the early 1990s called Australians and the Monarchy, and were thrilled when a couple of people from the palace attended, because one of the things that, of course, the palace keeps on having to work out is what's the likely longevity of the monarchy in the various former dominions. It's a sensible, you know, it's a diplomatic kind of approach to these things. So when we did the exhibition, we also looked at the rise of the Republican movement and the kind of Republican symbolism that you get. And at one point we had our comeuppance on this issue, because this particular exhibition called Australians and the Monarchy, one of the places it went to was the Gold Museum at Sovereign Hill in Ballarat. And as this afternoon here, there was an exit survey, and all of the Scandinavians who came to the exhibition said they enjoyed it, but why did Australia have a monarchy? So we had actually failed in this exhibition to explain that to an audience who just didn't take it for granted, because they hadn't grown up in either Britain or in one of the former dominions. So to the Scandinavians, we hadn't properly explained in the exhibition why the British monarch was also the Australian monarch. I guess the Republican movement was at its height in the sort of mid to late 1990s, and I suppose the interesting question now will be what's likely to happen over the next 10 or 15 years.
All right. Well, thank you, Peter. What we might do now is we'll talk to some of our guests here today who have brought in some objects for us to look at. So I'll start off here with the book account of the... belongs to Anne. Is Anne here? Oh, hello, Anne. Can you tell us a little bit about this book and its significance for you?
Well, this book actually belongs to my elder son, Tim. It was given to him by my two sisters, who bought it in an antiquarian bookshop in Bath, I think. They gave it to him for his 18th birthday, so that's about 25 years ago now. It's just quite fascinating to me. I mean, obviously, from the title there, you can see that Charles II himself was telling the story of his escape after the Battle of Worcester, where he was defeated by Cromwell's troops. And I read it again this morning. He told the story to Samuel Pepys. Samuel Pepys recorded it and gave the manuscript to the master of Magdalen College. I'm not quite sure why he did that, whether it was because he was a previous student of Magdalen. I don't know how the manuscript then came to the man who edited this, a man called David... I've forgotten now. I think it was Dalrymple. Was it Dalrymple?
Yeah, Dalrymple.
Okay.
Yep.
Who was a Scottish judge, I believe. But it's just such a fascinating story. And when I reread it, I wondered to myself why someone didn't turn it into a movie. You know, I could picture Russell Crowe, you know, doing this really well, though my friend here tells me there are better actors than Russell Crowe. But it really is a rollicking good yarn, and I could quite see why Charles II was so attractive to the women. You know, he was 6'2" and adventurous and not averse to sitting up a tree for a whole day and watching what was going on. It's a wonderful story. So as I said, sadly it's not mine. It belongs to my son. But you know how married sons tend to leave things at home, at their old home. They say no room in their own house. So that's the story anyway. I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Yes.
I do have one question, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's dedicated to Thomas Hollis, who was the Chancellor of Cambridge University.
Yep.
I wondered, was he the Thomas Hollis who became Prime Minister of England at some stage? Do you know?
I have no idea, sorry.
I'm not sure, but you could easily answer that question on Google.
It was a bit confusing. I tried, but there were several.
Several of them.
Several of them. Yes.
I think it's a lovely sort of a lovely edition of the book, and I think your son's very lucky.
And isn't it terrific where it says, as you can all see on the title page, drawn up by himself. It's a touch of Mr. Darcy on the title page there, isn't it?
Yeah. So that there's the inscription you were just talking about.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And one of the, from the point of view of a book collector, of course, one of the great things about this edition is that it is so obvious that it's been done by hot metal printing, because you can actually see the imprint. When you look at the, you know, what's called the title verso of the title page, you can see the way the metal type has hit the page, and almost, it's very interesting. It's a terrific object from that point of view, because it, this sort of printing isn't, it's hardly ever done anymore, of course. So,
yeah.
It's fantastic.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Anne, for bringing that along today.
Pleasure.
Okay, so next up, we've got the teapot, which we can see over there, but I'll put it up on the screen so everybody can see it a bit better. And this belongs to Gillian. Are you here today, Gillian? Hi. Thank you very much for bringing the teapot in. Can you tell us how you acquired this and what its significance for you it is?
I got it by accident. I thought it was bargeware. And so I was very intrigued by it, but then I saw photographs of real bargeware, and it doesn't resemble any pictures I've seen. And I took a closer look at it after Anne asked me to bring something along. And I see that the handle is in the form of an anchor, and there are Prince of Wales feathers around the top. And I thought, well, perhaps it's not the coronation of our dear Queen, but somewhat earlier.
It does look a bit earlier to me. What do you think, Peter?
I would have guessed about 1890s, but
yeah.
As you say, there are no maker's marks on it, so that we're not helped from that point of view.
And it looks hand-painted, and
yep.
I'd put it into the 19th century as well.
I was thinking George V because of his association with the Navy. And he was Prince of Wales for an awfully long time.
I think it's a lovely piece. Of course, what makes pieces more valuable is more information and the history of ownership. But it's a very attractive piece. But I'd have to say it's a mystery to me as to exactly which royal it celebrates, or whether you're just seeing the use of sort of royal iconography as a decoration.
Yes, what you'd have to hope is that the various elements here somehow might make it possible to date it more accurately.
Yes,
There probably will be a handful of experts around the world on this, but they're not always easy to find.
Unfortunately, they're not sitting on the stage today. But no, it is a beautiful object. Thank you very much for bringing that one along. Let's have a look what else we've got here. We've got a... Oh, sorry, I've gone for a little bit quickly there. The Souvenir magazine, and this one is Rhonda's. Are you here, Rhonda?
Yes,
hello, Rhonda. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came by this one?
Well, my collection started in 1950 when my parents inherited my grandparents' home, and I discovered in the cellar Hessian bags full of magazines dating from 20s, 30s and 40s. And this one was amongst it, and it started my collection.
What do you collect?
Well, I don't anymore, but I've still got the ones I did from when I was a teenager, just cutouts of periodicals and
in the royal area, primarily.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes.
Of the royal family.
Yep. Yep.
And this was given to me in 1952 at school for the royal visit that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you were issued with this in anticipation of the royal visit.
Yes.
And, of course, you'd already had this long-term interest.
Yes.
So did you focus on magazines and programs?
Yes. I think relatives must have given me lots of magazines and books for birthday presents, etc. And I've got quite a large collection of Women's Weekly cutouts and that sort of thing.
So it's interesting then, isn't it, how many collections actually do start by one bit of happenstance early on, like your account of what was in the Hessian bags.
Yes.
So, because I think people often think, you know, that all collectors are nutters and that they haven't got anything better to do than watch Antique Roadshow and... you know, that somehow they're, you know, going to become wealthy because they can pick out bargains or something or other, and they don't actually realise that the actual origins of a lot of collections are you know, often go back to childhood and might have nothing to do with the wider world of antique collecting in the first instance.
Well, it's quite fascinating looking at some of the Woman's Weeklies that I kept in their entirety. Now, our granddaughter who's come along with us, she said, "What's a girdle?" We have this a full-page ad of, yep, from Hickory of these girdles.
Yes. Well, Guy will probably remember this conversation before, but one of the great ironies of collecting long runs of popular periodicals is that libraries didn't take them very seriously. So there was a girly magazine produced in Sydney from the late 1930s called Man Magazine, which most people would primarily
think
of.
We weren't
allowed to look there. But it actually had some quite good journalism in it in the late 1930s.
He only read it for the articles.
In the late 1930s. And so a few years back, I was at the Mornings and Tyab antique market with one of my sons, who was then aged about 10. And this antique dealer in her late 70s had all these copies of Man magazine from the late 1950s. So I bought them all. Now, remember, this antique dealer's in her late 70s, and she could see I've got my son with me. And she said, "I didn't think you'd be that kind of man." And then she put a hand over her mouth and said, "Oh, perhaps I shouldn't have said that." Because the whole question was, what did she think that kind of a man was? It was a magazine that you'd find.
She'd obviously read them.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, she had them there. It was the kind of magazine you'd find in a men's barber shop and you'd never have found in a female hair salon. Yeah.
Yes. So is this one of yours?
This is my scrapbook, yes. I think that my grandchildren would say, "Why didn't you go out and buy a scrapbook?" But it wasn't done in the early 50s. We were still poor, I suppose. I just stuck pictures upon pictures and glued them all together with flour and water paste.
See, from the historian's point of view, the magazine covers are better, including the Weldon's one, because we've got the date and the source. Yeah.
Curator's point of view, I'm perfectly happy because the object speaks to your interest in the family. So I think the object's got a life of its own.
Sure.
Well, thank you very much for bringing that along. Okay, so let me return to the main menu and we'll find out what we've got next. We've got the... Oh, there we go. I've gone one too far. This belongs to Roz. Roz, I think I saw you. Here you are. You're over here. So, Roz, can you tell us a little bit about how you acquired this object?
Is this the coin that dates from the Jubilee of 1977, at which time I was actually a young mum, unemployed, and was able then, by means of being unemployed, to go to the exhibition in the train at Central Station that was mounted for the Jubilee. And I bought this souvenir coin at that particular event. The thing that stands out for me most in that exhibition, which was quite comprehensive, and it was in a railway carriage that was very smart and silver and blue, was the shirt that had been worn by King Charles I for his beheading outside the banqueting house at Whitehall. And this was probably the most interesting, if not the most gruesome, artefact in the whole collection, but that's probably the only thing that really sticks in my mind at this distance in time.
Who'd put it together, Roz? Do you know?
I think it came out from England. You probably remember it, Peter. It toured in this train, country areas and things, and of course sat in Central Station for quite a long time so Sydney siders could see it, and presumably went to the other capitals as well. But I think it was authorised by the royal household, and it was obviously things they thought that the ex-dominions would be interested in seeing, and it was quite an artefact. The other things I have completely forgotten, I have to say, but that stuck in my mind.
But you've since discovered, with a bit of Google research, that this is a coin of the realm.
Yes.
That has no indication of its value on it.
Absolutely none. No, I mean, I thought it was a medal.
Yeah.
In fact, it comes in that little plastic case with what looks like a German eagle on it for some inexplicable reason. And has the Queen on horseback.
And what was its denomination if it had been printed on it?
It was a crown.
A crown.
Yes, a 25 pence, presumably. But there's nothing on it to say that you could actually spend it.
I think you should now be empowered to go to Heathrow Airport and see if you can pick up something with it. or whether you'll just be arrested because you're trying to, you know, pass off a medal as currency.
I think the latter is more likely, Peter. Yes.
Thanks for bringing that in, Ross. Okay, so let's see what we've got next. I think we've got some more ceramics.
We do, yep.
So here we go. This is Sue's, isn't it? Hello, Sue.
It is. Hello.
So tell me about the mug. A mug's perhaps too common a word. What are we
looking at? I know. In 2004, my husband became the property manager of Australia House, and so we went to live in England for 4 years. I applied for a job with the Royal Collection, who are the employment arm of the Royal Household. I won a job there for 4 years. I worked in security, as they refer to them affectionately as wardens. You wear the Windsor uniform of Prince Charles, and your job is to make sure that nobody touches things in Buckingham Palace, Clarence House, the Queen's Gallery or the Royal Mews. At the end of every summer, if you worked in Clarence House, you were given a mug by the Prince of Wales of the Clarence House pattern, that is of the Queen Mother. For those of you who might have been into Clarence House, the morning room, which Charles had done up after his grandmother died, he still kept in the colours of his grandmother, pale blue and beige being her horse racing colours. But all the wardens that, as I said, worked in Clarence House were given one of these mugs. I have four, of which I am very, very proud, and they no longer are given out because the pottery venue that used to make them, of course, in Stoke-on-Trent, no longer exists. Mm. So when you go and work now, you are given a mug from the palace. So when you were talking about with William being married, because I'm going to the wedding, it is very interesting that the Royal Collection will put out very much quality pottery. And you can buy that. You can buy it online. You can buy it in their three shops. So it's very, if you're going to buy something like that, it's very important that you have the stamp, like mine has on the bottom, the Royal Collection, which is actually has the imprimatur of the employment arm of the royal family.
Well, as you can see, it is a very fine bit of china, so it's very interesting to compare, say, to this object.
Yes.
From both a collector's point of view and, I guess, a museum display point of view, the fact that you've got a personal story that goes with it is great, obviously, and that you've got four years.
Yes.
And I assume you've kept all the boxes.
I have kept all the boxes.
Very good.
I'm a true collector.
Yeah, because the boxes count too, as you know.
And the tissue paper, because it has the royal crowns on it.
Yep.
For the Queen Mother, she also put her imprimatur on what they call Chelsea pottery, so that when you go to Clarence House, in the morning room, you have two recessed rooms, and in those, recessed cupboards that are glass shelving, and that's where you can see Chelsea pottery, and you can still buy that through the Royal Collection. It's quite expensive, of course, having the Queen Mother's imprimatur on it, but yes, it's the most beautiful of pottery.
Well, it is intriguing, I think, that there's obviously been a very long and time-honoured tradition of fine pottery and porcelain in the UK.
Yes.
But, of course, what we're going to find with the coming wedding is that there'll be two or three waves of production. Yep. Then you'll have the fine pottery production, and then you'll have the mass market stuff from China as well.
Exactly.
Obviously.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm.
Thank you very much for bringing that in, Sue.
Pleasure.
Now, we've been talking about coins and their role. So we've actually got somebody from the Mint here, Felicity.
Yes.
So we've got a range of images here of objects from the Mint. So we've got Silver Jubilee 50 cents, Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the coins which the Mint produces in relation to the royals?
Sure. We've got quite a proud and long heritage, actually, of producing royal memorabilia, I suppose, and probably royal memorabilia that made it into the pockets of pretty much all Australians. So most of our collectibles are really quite prolific. We were opened by the royal family. We actually, an interesting point, we had the Queen out in 2006, and some members of the Mint got to go along. And I think one of my fondest memories of that is we sent one of the gentlemen from our proof room, who is really quite young and really quite baby-faced, and the Queen was having a chat with him and said, "How long have you been working at the Mint?" And he said, 16 years. And it was quite funny because usually she's sort of quite reserved and very well, sort of very well composed, and she sort of reeled back and she said, "Goodness gracious, did you start when you were six?" Like, and it was really quite sweet because she actually really broke with sort of like the protocol of saying, you know, "Lovely to meet you," and walking along. So that was quite nice, and we've got photos of that, and this young man that works in the proof room, like everyone now calls him Babyface. And yeah, so.
Speaking of people who age gracefully, the Queen herself in her portrayal on the coins, you can see here's from 2000, and you can see the signs of ageing, but they're not overly pronounced, are they? But it's a very graceful, her visage on the coins, it's a graceful growing old, isn't
it? We've only had to change the portrait four times. So if maybe you even flick back through your own photo album and think about all the different images and looks you've had over the years, you're right, she has aged particularly gracefully. This portrait was actually done by our Australian engraver, Vladimir Gottwald, and it came second as the effigy chosen to be the main effigy on all the circulating currency. So the person who I guess there was a bit of a competition, not that there was prize money or anything, but Ian Rank Broadley's portrait was selected as the primary portrait. So we use that, and Britain uses that, but Canada uses their own, which is not that good. And you should actually grab a look at, you know, if you can, have a look at the Canadian coins, and they are really quite different. This one was designed by Stuart Devlin, who is the Queen's goldsmith and jeweller. Again, I don't think it hits the mark in terms of portraiture, but yeah, he is the chosen goldsmith.
No, it looks like a French plot to me.
Yeah. And you'll notice, I don't know if you've seen any of the recent coins come out for William and Kate, but the Royal Mint has just very recently issued their engagement coin on an Alderney effigy, and I wouldn't recognise them unless I knew that's who it was. But I can't show you that pic, but it is available on the websites. But again, Vladimir, who designed that first portrait that you saw in 2000 of the Queen, he has done the effigies for William and Kate, and they're spot on.
So you will have merchandise associated with the royal wedding?
We will. We announced an engagement coin coming out earlier this year, and because we've got such a heritage of doing these types of collectibles, we'll certainly have something in this space, which I've seen on the drawing boards, and it's now just been signed off by Buckingham Palace last Thursday, so it's all official and ready to go. So the Queen and the Prince and Kate, even though Kate didn't give her word, I was told that Clarence House speaks for her now. I thought that was rather nice.
Well, thank you very much for bringing in these images and talking about coins, because you're right, that is something that everybody likes to collect, is the coins. So some wonderful images there, and really fascinating stuff. We've actually run slightly... how are we doing there?
We're doing fine.
Yep. So we actually, I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions from the audience, and we do have about 5 minutes, so that's really good. So questions here.
Thank you very much. I have a cup and saucer at home amongst hundreds of objects, which has the royal. It's only very ordinary blue and white. The royal visit in 1949. And the only thing I have on the saucer is a portrait, too, of Princess Margaret Rose. But what happened to the 1949, I wonder?
The king fell ill, so the royal tour didn't happen.
In 49?
Yep. Oh, right. So there's quite a bit. So you've got this 1949 tour, where the king would have come, didn't happen, and then the 1952 tour that didn't happen, which was going to be then the then Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip. Yep.
And the interesting thing about that 1949 tour is some people speculate as to what impact it would have had on Australian politics, because you've got, you know, the post-war, you've got Chifley as Prime Minister, the Royal Tour, would Chifley have been able to get some of the popularity of having the first monarch? Would it have changed Australian history if the Royal Tour had happened in 49 rather than Menzies becoming forever associated? So it's quite interesting to think about that object of a tour which never happened. I like those objects of the tours which didn't happen. I think it's like these alternative histories, these counterfactuals. They're really interesting objects.
Well, it's like the mug I have of King Edward VIII.
Mm.
But no, that's not right, is it? Well, anyway, because he didn't take the... But I also have something I'd like to show you later, which is a photo of my father with the Queen.
Oh, good. And when we go down to the main hall, if people have brought some other things with them, we're having a cup of tea in the main hall, there'd be a bit of a chance for you to pull some things out then and have a bit of a chat. So I don't want you to feel that you've completely missed out your opportunities. But any other questions up the top there? And we've got a microphone coming to you because we are recording the event. Sorry. No, I was pointing up there. But you go first and then we'll come to you. You go first.
Right, I just have to say downstairs I've got a number of items going from 1902 to present times. That one of them is a 1949 plate. I'm wondering if the Museum of Australia would be interested in it. It's a portrait of what I call Lizzie Mother Dear and George the Sixth Royal Tour 1949. My mother got it in West Wyalong. It was sold for about a couple of bob or something at a hardware shop. They must have been able to get rid of it. But it is another item for 49. So that's downstairs and I'll show you when I get downstairs.
Yeah, good. I think what Peter and I've observed is that there is quite a lot of stuff about the 49 tour does turn up.
You're quite right that it would have been sold off quite promptly because, of course, as soon as it was known that the tour wasn't going to happen, what did you do with the stock?
And up the top there.
Yes, I'm interested in the international royal collections. Today's presentation has been primarily on the royalty with the Association of Australia. But obviously there's collector interest in New Zealand and UK itself, of course. But have you got any feel for where the worldwide collection of royal memorabilia, and do Australian collectors collect royal memorabilia for royal visits to other countries? I'm not a royal collector myself. I'm just interested in the possible worldwide movement.
I think most people tend to concentrate on a particular country with their royal collection. I've just been in the North Island and New Zealand, and I'd say there's more royal material in antique shops in New Zealand now than you'd find in Australia, which is interesting, and it's still quite a good place to buy some of the Australian souvenirs. But you wouldn't have... sometimes also people don't understand the complexity of monarchical organisations in Australia. So there's a famous historian of the British aristocracy called David Cannadine who came to the conference we ran on the monarchy in London. And he couldn't believe it when I explained that Australia wasn't actually one monarchy, it was seven. Because coming from the UK and a central government, this guy is, you know, well-educated, Cambridge-educated, he's been a professor for 30 years. He had no idea there were six state governors in Australia, all also representing the Queen. He just stared at me and thought... And, of course, you don't get that in New Zealand because it's got a central government as well. So you've got other oddities here where every state government has got to position itself with the monarchy as well as the federal government. So back to Guy's interesting comment about what would have happened if the Royal Tour in 49 had gone ahead. In 1954, there was a fantastic dispute between Menzies, the Protestant Prime Minister, and Joe Carl, the Catholic Labor Premier of New South Wales, about who would greet the Queen first when she arrived in Sydney Harbour on the SS Gothic. So the solution was that Bob Menzies got to meet her on the water and Joe welcomed her on the land.
which
because
is
because the land was New South Wales land, yeah. and he was a New South Wales premier, but Menzies could meet her on the water.
And that spot is in Lady Macquarie's chair, and yep. there's actually a sandstone wall and an inscription that shows you exactly where it happened. So if you're walking around the botanical gardens, you can actually see that spot which Peter's talking about. Just on international collections, a collector like Cecil Ballard, who I showed you a picture of before, will collect any royal memorabilia from anywhere. So there are the collectors who are fascinated by all aspects, but say the collections of the National Museum of Australia, we very much focus on the connection with Australia. And of course, there is the palace itself, as has already been explained to us, has very significant collections of perhaps not so much memorabilia, but really material associated with the royals. And we're very interested in the costume and jewellery collection which Queen Elizabeth has. And if we ever have the chance to do another exhibition, there'd be some very significant dresses which she wore and were very famous in Australia. The wattle dress is one which I would love to find out where that is. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to find that. It doesn't seem to be in the royal collection. But there was also jewellery which was presented to the Queen on her visit, and some quite famous pieces, Australian pieces, were designed. And it would be lovely to see them come back to Australia for display as well. So it's an interesting question. And we have a question here.
No, I don't have a question. I have a comment. Sure. For those of you who go to England and go during the summer opening of Buckingham Palace, there's always a theme. And for one of those years, they did do Australian memorabilia, that of gifts that had been given by the Australian government to Her Majesty, and so they were shown. But I think one of the that year, they also incorporated New Zealand, and I was quite impressed because they actually gave her a stereo made out of New Zealand timber. So, yes, it's there. Goodness knows where they put it, but it's there.
That's very interesting. And a question up the top here. Just sort of midway, sorry. Just here.
Yep.
Microphone is coming to you.
Has there ever been a minor royal that has featured in this memorabilia that by some mishap or some popularity or... I mean, we've got the Queen or Kings, but has there ever been a minor royal figure that has...
A minor royal figure?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. The royal collections which we hold are... Yeah. A populated. I mean, the thing about ceramics is you'll find there is the sort of the additions of ceramics which relate to Charles Dye, the Queen. But there is the very Franklin Mint and various other companies produce a huge range of materials going down several layers of the royal family. So they do appear in various ways, and you know, as their celebrity perhaps declines, you don't see as much. But in the magazines and the celebrity-style magazines, the minor royals are followed quite closely as well. If they manage to embarrass the House of Windsor, they will get their photograph in quite prominently as well. So,
and to make an obvious point, I mean, the Prince of Wales, when he's the Prince of Wales and hasn't met Mrs. Simpson, he visits Australia in 1920, so that produces a lot of material. Given one of my other interests... the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge is one of the few major events in Australian history which wasn't presided over by a member of the British Royal Family, whereas the opening of the new Parliament House here was. Most of the state centenaries and sesquicentenaries saw a member of the British Royal Family coming out. Victoria in 1934, New South Wales in 1938, and so on.
Jack Lang's ego?
I think it was a combination of... Jack Lang and the fact that the New Guard were demanding that the Harbour Bridge be opened by a member of the Royal Family. So Jack Lang decided it wouldn't be.
Okay. We have just two more questions, one there and there, and then we'll finish up and we can get a nice cup of tea after that.
Hi. Sue and I have a very reasonably comprehensive collection, and one of the challenges we looked at was to see how far back we could go. And we discovered that in the early Victorian era, there wasn't too much about. Like, we do have a very ugly vase and a few other things. But I was talking to a dealer one time, and he was a coin dealer as well, And he said, if you're interested in going back as far as you can, then look at coins. So at one stage, we've picked up a silver sixpence from Elizabeth the First era, 1532, I think it is. And that was part of a hoard, because you can still see quite clearly her her image on that coin. And it's interesting to see just sort of how far you can go, because before things were being mass-produced, obviously there were some lovely pieces around, but they were fairly rare and obviously quite expensive.
And another comment I'd make, I suppose, on that from the point of view of the collectors, is that certain collectibles always retain their value because they appeal to multiple markets. So the coins that you're talking about are going to have a numismatic market as well as a royal market, if you see what I mean. So it's quite interesting when you look at anybody's collection as to what's cost a lot and what hasn't. And it's often when there are multiple people interested in it that it gets really expensive. And with the early ceramics as well, of course. Yeah.
I've got a piece of material, at least it's a hanky, with 1953 on it, and the arms, coat of arms, and Buckingham Palace and Westminster Abbey. I know materials probably are very much harder to preserve. China, well, it can break, but I've wondered how to keep this so that it could last much longer, make, you know, conservation. Maybe you could tell me a bit how you would go with materials.
Well, two different sorts of comments. I mean, a guy might want to comment in this from the conservator's point of view. People would often lightly frame something like that, but if you're framing it, you've got to be very careful how you place it in the frame so it's not being pinned in such a way that the textiles might drag a bit. What is interesting is that one of my friends in Brisbane has Australia's largest historical tea towel collection. And he simply keeps them folded up, as they always were, in a room with a dehumidifier. And they're fine. So that often with textiles, simply in something like a hanky, just keeping it the way it was originally folded. But it is important that it's not going to get mouldy, so the humidity is your biggest enemy, really.
In terms of maintaining it, the best thing to do is keep it in a dark, dry place.
It's in a desk.
And you can put it in acid-free tissue paper, and you can, if you want it to be flat, you can put it between two pieces of archival board, cardboard. It depends how far you want to go. But Peter's right. If you just keep it clean and dry and don't put it in the sunlight, sunlight is the enemy. Hanging it is a problem because gravity begins to take effect. But they're very straightforward, common sense things, and they're not dissimilar to what we do in our own storage areas.
So the rarest items always tend to be paper-based things. So there are a lot of little paper flags made for the 54 Royal Tour, and it's very hard to find one of them that's not badly wounded. And it's fairly hard to find one of these, which I was going to give to Guy so I don't have to take it back with me. There's already one of these in your collection, which is a cardboard periscope produced for the 54 Royal Tour, so that if you were a bit shorter, you could hold it up, be looking at this end, and see the Queen from that end, you see. Yeah. They're quite common. I mean, literally 100,000 of them at least were made and sold for what was called the Royal Progress, so that you could be sure that you could see the...
I love the sort of arcane link to Gallipoli as well. That's fantastic, Peter. I mean, the National Museum would be delighted to add that to the collection, but I'm assuming you were giving it to us.
Yes.
But look, that's been a fantastic session. I've really enjoyed hearing your stories about your objects. It's a great privilege to hear Peter and bring his expertise to the table. And it's not over yet. We've got a cup of tea in the main hall, opportunity for you to talk more about your interest in collecting and what you have in your own collections. I should just say a few thank yous, of course. Thank you to Leanne and Heidi, who do a lot of the hard work in setting Collector Fest up, the sound guys who are sitting up in a booth up there, and I can't quite see them. Yes, they're there, and they do a great job as well. So, and of course, thanks to you guys for coming. Very much appreciate it. So thank you very much.